Mr. and Mrs. Radioland. I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO because Portland needs it, you need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagani, boing boing.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Saddle up and ride with country music in your head from 6 till 9 every Saturday morning on KBOO Swingin' Country. You can count on Swingin' Country's stable of rotating hosts to fill your early morning with country, alternative country, western, western swing, and even some rockabilly, bluegrass, and Americana tunes. Swingin' Country on KBOO is mighty fine, Saturday morning, 6 to 9.
If your eyes are on me, you're looking at country.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel.
Hi, Stephen.
We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month. And typically we interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools, in their unions. But today we have a special guest, an education advocate, and that is Leonie Hameson. Welcome, Leonie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're excited to have you here. So could we start by just having you introduce yourself and your role in advocating for public education, and maybe start with sort of also how you got started and what have some of your priorities been in your advocacy work?
So I started getting interested in education advocacy about 25 years ago, actually. I was always interested in education policy, but not as an advocate, just as an onlooker. But my daughter, who attended a public school in New York City, was in a first grade. She had a class size of 29. And I volunteered occasionally to help her teacher out. And I was in the classroom packing up supplies and stuff before a vacation. And her teacher, who was probably the best teacher in the school, had a great reputation, very experienced, very effective, confided that she prayed for days when just a few kids were absent, because it made all the difference in the world to being able to teach the rest of the class effectively. And so I was kind of shocked by this, and I started doing some research on my own. And I had always thought that, you know, New York City public schools have a lot of immigrant kids, have a lot of poor kids, and we're essentially doing the best that we can with the high level of needs of the students that we have in New York City. But I very quickly realized through research two things I hadn't been aware of, which was, number one, the research was very strong that class size was linked to student success. And number two, New York City had the largest class sizes in the state. So I was really personally offended by this notion. And so I started looking at advocacy groups in New York City that were interested in the issue of class size. And there was one in particular, and I invited them to come speak to the parents at my child's school and started doing outreach myself on some of the issues related to class size. And then that organization, which was called Educational Priorities Panel, actually asked me to come work part-time doing writing and parent outreach for them. And so after a while working with that organization, I founded my own organization, Class Size Matters. And ever since, I've been focused full-time on providing information about the benefits of smaller classes to parents, teachers, and officials nationwide, but focusing my advocacy primarily in New York City to lower class sizes. About 10 years ago, I also got very involved in the issue of student privacy, which is the other second main focus I have, and I founded a national organization called Parent Coalition for Student Privacy.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Sounds like you've been busy there. So we invited you on the show, obviously, to talk about class size, although I know that we're also interested in student privacy as well. Class size is a key issue impacting educators' working conditions and, of course, students' learning conditions. Can you say a little bit more? I mean, you kind of answered this, but you want to say a little bit more about why you decided to make class size your primary focus?
Well, class size is an issue which I think instinctively most parents understand is important in teachers being able to give their kids the attention they deserve. Teachers obviously understand that through experience. But then the research is very, very strong. So some of the best research that's ever been done in the field of education, a large-scale randomized experiment called the STAR experiment many years ago was done in the state of Tennessee, and it showed that kids in smaller classes do better in every way that can be measured. They get better test scores, better grades, fewer disciplinary problems, a whole host of really important benefits. But the thing that's maybe most important about the research is that smaller classes have been shown to narrow the achievement or the opportunity gap between disadvantaged kids, kids from low-income families, kids with special needs, kids from racial minorities, who need the help the most. And there are very, very few education reforms or policies that have been shown to narrow that gap. And it's for that reason, I think it's a critical reform, especially for school districts with a lot of poor disadvantaged kids.
So are there specific recommendations for optimal class size numbers in the research that you've looked at?
So there's no real research showing what the optimal class size is. Generally speaking, the smaller, the better. But I think that a good guideline to use would be if you could get class sizes down to 15, that would be pretty ideal. Most independent elite private schools have class sizes of no more than 15. There's a boarding school called Exeter, which is basically probably one of the most elite schools in the world that teaches the ruling class. They have something called the Harkness table, which they use in all their classrooms, which seats only 12 students and one teacher. And so those are pretty ideal class sizes. You know, we passed a law in New York City, which I guess we'll talk about in 2022, which caps class sizes at 20 in K through 3, 23 in 4th through 8th grade, and 25 in high school. We didn't push for class sizes of 15 or less because we thought it'd be both politically impossible and far too expensive. But really what the research shows is the smaller the better, but it's roughly linear. So whatever your class size is now, even if it's above 30, to get it to under 30 will yield benefits. To get it from 28 to 25 will yield benefits. There are a lot of myths around the issue of class size used by opponents towards reducing class size. One of them is that there is a threshold that you need to get under to show benefits, and you could never get under that threshold of 18 or 15, but there's lots of research to disprove that as well. So I think that, you know, that basically whatever you think is politically possible, economically possible, you should lower class sizes to those limits. But, you know, 15 in an ideal world would be really terrific.
Yeah. So you've brought up actually sort of a lot of issues here, both the academic sort of outcomes, but also some of the soft skills of achievement, like communication and emotional intelligence and flexibility, things like that. But I wonder, let's like dig in a little to the research, because I think that this is where education reformers have kind of used research to their own advantage, or some research. I know over the past few decades, that education reformers have pushed the narrative that class size does not matter. And one example was a 2011 Harvard study that looked at students at charter schools. But we know that charter schools can control who attends and who remains at their school, as opposed to public schools, like you mentioned, who are mandated to educate every child that comes in. So it really is like comparing apples and oranges. So what are some important factors other than the type of school when you're interpreting different research studies, things to really pay attention to?
Well, first of all, I don't really want to give over the description of reformers to the other side. I think that we shouldn't allow them to monopolize that term, because I consider myself a reformer as well. I think the other side that has pushed competition, charter schools, weakening teacher tenure, evaluating schools and teachers via test scores, those are corporate reformers. And so we talk about a different kind of reform, which really meets students' needs where they are and where the research evidence is actually very strong. I'm not that aware of the Harvard study. I don't think that that particular study has been that influential, but there's been conservative economists like Eric Kanishek of the Hoover Institute for a long time has pushed the notion that money doesn't matter, and against really spending money on public education, whereas most all the research shows that spending money on public education really yields tremendous benefits. And then later on, the Gates Foundation financed a lot of bogus studies, basically summaries of other research in which they wanted to downplay the issue of class size in favor of the other conservative corporate reform agenda. The question you had was what to look at in terms of research. Mm-hmm. And I think the main things you should look at when you're looking at research is, one, the best sort of research are experimental randomized studies like the STAR study, in which there's not a lot of confounding factors. So you look at groups of students and then you randomly assign them to different sorts of experiences. And then you see what the outcomes are. But there are very few good experimental randomized studies in the field of education, unfortunately. Then you looked at peer-reviewed studies, you know, the studies that have been published in peer-reviewed journals. You also should look at who sponsored or paid for it, because, as I said, there are a lot of very political organizations out there, like the Gates Foundation, who sponsor these studies, and they tend often not to be very good studies. And if you're looking at class size in particular, if they say it's not cost-effective, look at what they say would be more cost-effective. And often they have either nothing to offer or they offer up lots of other sorts of options which have no research behind them whatsoever. So there's been a fairly influential summary of the research by the Brookings Institute that was also funded by the Gates Foundation, where the other options were, expanding charter schools, eliminating teacher tenure, a bunch of other things which have not been shown to work in terms of either improving student achievement or student outcomes in any way whatsoever. So those are some of the ways I would look at the research. But you also have to really, really think very clearly about the political bias of the people who are writing and what their goals actually, their larger goals actually are.
What about, are you familiar with John Hattie?
Yeah, I am familiar, unfortunately, with his work. I think it's really shoddy in many, many ways. He tends to look at meta studies where you put together a whole lot of studies and then you sort of synthesize them in a way that doesn't really make any sense to me. So people who know statistics, who understand how to carry out a research study, don't give much credence into the way John Hattie ranks different education reforms. In fact, if you look at what, I can't remember exactly, but if you look at what he considers most effective, and then you look at what class size does, often class size leads to the conditions of those programs, which he says are most effective. So I don't think his research makes any sense at all.
Great. I was hoping you would say that. So audience, if you're just joining us, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Labor Radio. Unlike corporate media, KBOO is commercial free and relies on you, the listener, to function and survive on the air. So if you are able, please go to kboo.fm/give to make a one-time donation, or better yet, to become a monthly donor. And joining us right now, we have Leonie Hampson, and this is so great to be talking about class size with you. So I wanted to just run something by you. So I'm a special education teacher. One of the things that I'm doing this year is I'm going into a couple of general education classes. Class sizes are both of those are probably in the upper 20s. They're not huge classes, but they're up there. They're probably about 27, 28 if all the students are there in attendance. So we have two adults in those classes, and I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that sort of model and pushing for that versus having a smaller class size.
So the STAR study that I mentioned earlier, which is probably the best large-scale randomized experiment ever done in education, looked at kids randomly assigned to three different kinds of classrooms, with one teacher in a medium-sized class, or large to medium size, one teacher in a smaller class, and then a medium-sized class with a teacher and an aide. And they found absolutely no benefits to the class with the teacher and the aide. In New York City, we have many, many classrooms. We've had a big expansion of ICT or inclusion classes with two teachers, including up to 40% of special needs students. There's very little research to show whether that's worked or not, and there's very little research in general about whether it works to put two teachers in a classroom. Often, parents of kids with special needs who are in inclusion classes in New York City ask to have their kids taken out of the class because it's too large, chaotic, and noisy for their kid, even with two teachers. Over the years, I've visited many ICT classes. Sometimes it tends to work well, and sometimes it doesn't tend to work well. The second teacher in a classroom is sort of put to the side and does a lot of administrative tasks while the first teacher is doing the work. And obviously, there's no benefit for the mm-hmm. for the student in that way. Yeah. When you're doing whole class instruction and the second teacher is just sort of sitting by, or sitting at a table somewhere in the back of the room trying to keep those kids in the back of the room engaged, it doesn't seem to, from observation, doesn't work very well either. So if you do a lot of project-based learning where you're separating kids out into groups and they can focus well within that, even that larger class environment, I think it can be valuable. And it's certainly on average, probably better than just having one teacher in a room. But whether it's actually cost effective, I would doubt. Because if you had the space, if you had two teachers in a classroom, for example, and you had the space to split those classes up, I think that the results would be much better. For example, in New York City, where, you know, the class size limits, the UFT, union contractual caps are like 32 through fifth grade. If you had two teachers in a classroom, that would yield classes of 16 kids each, which would be near ideal.
Yeah.
So I guess the other argument for it is that one teacher will be better trained in teaching special education students. And then therefore, if you have an inclusion class, it's important to have a teacher with that training. Whether that would outweigh the value of having a much smaller class, I'm really not sure. And the research has just not been done to show.
Yeah, great. And then you're based in New York. You've talked some about you mentioned the cap sizes between 20 and 25, depending on the grade level. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's happening there? And then also curious if there are models besides some of these elite private schools that we can look to.
Yeah, so New York City, we've had various class size initiatives over the year that have not worked that well because the city has not complied with the guidelines of the additional funding that they've gotten to lower class size. We passed a law in 2022 in the state legislature that tries to tighten that up because we're getting more money from the state finally as a result of a longstanding education equity lawsuit. The class sizes are supposed to be capped, phased in over 5 years to no more than 20 in K-3, 23 in 4-8 grade, and 25 in high school. We're in the second year of that phase in. It's supposed to increase by 20% of classes every year. We have real problems with the way it's being implemented because there's no long-term plan to provide the space for smaller classes, either by balancing enrollment across nearby schools or by building enough schools where all those schools are overcrowded. So we don't believe that we're going to hit the benchmarks in the law in years 3 to 5 without a big push from the state. So we helped write that law and we put in accountability and enforcement into the law. That allows the state education department to hold back funding if the city is not complying. We believe the city is not complying, and so we're pushing the state education department to do their job and really require a real 5-year plan. You asked about other states and other countries. In 2002, the state of Florida passed a class size amendment through referendum, which capped class sizes at even lower levels of 18 in grades K-3, 22 in 4-8 grade, 25 in high school. We believe that yielded really great results early on, especially for disadvantaged groups, especially for Hispanic students. And Florida really jumped ahead in terms of achievement at that point, but it's been the gains have been vitiated over time by my understanding more and more classes and getting exemptions from the caps. Oh. In France, when Macron was elected, he early on in 2017, he put together a program to cut class sizes to 12 in the early grades in the highest needs communities. And that was a result of research by the economist Thomas Piketty, who hypothesized by looking at the research that capping class sizes at 15 in high poverty schools would essentially eliminate the achievement gap between racial and economic groups. Some of that research, follow-up research, has shown important results from that, not eliminating the achievement gap, but making big gain, big difference. Narrowing the achievement gap.
Wow. I'm going to need to do some research on France. That sounds amazing. I know that much of our education policy comes down to money, either budgetary restraints or seeing public education as a business opportunity. How do you see these two factors driving decisions around public education and class size in particular?
Well, obviously, reducing class size is not cheap. You do need to hire more teachers, and then in many overcrowded districts, you need to build more schools to provide the space or expand the schools that you have. It gets caught in the politics around education, which are, you know, extremely vituperative and very, very intense right now. And in general, the politics of education are extremely intense. But over the years, class size has been an issue that parents from all different political stripes agreed upon that it was an important thing to do because they understood instinctively that class size matters to their kids. But there's a whole lot of people on the right wing, especially corporate leaders and other wealthy individuals who don't like spending money on education, don't like spending money on government programs at all. And in general, you know, at the state and the local level, education is probably the biggest spending program that there is. And so they will argue against spending money in any case, even though the research is very strong on class size and that the more you spend on education, the better the outcomes. They will do everything they can to oppose that. Even though there are long-term studies, economic studies that show smaller classes yield economic benefits that are twice the cost. And Alan Krueger, who was at one point the chief economist of the Labor Department, did a lot of those studies, which I point you to. And there's been even more research recently that's showing education spending yields tremendous benefits. I think I mentioned the Gates Foundation, but there are other, you know, even further right-wing organizations and think tanks that now want to push privatization of our public school system and tax credit scholarships for private schools, vouchers, and, of course, charter schools. So they would prefer the private sector to take over. There's also many ed tech companies or technology companies that are pushing ed tech over reducing class sizes and falsely claiming that AI and the increased use of ed tech will, quote unquote, personalize learning in a way that similar to class size reduction. And of course, we know that that's not true. We know that putting kids on computers does not do the same things that lowering class size does. I had hoped after the pandemic, when so much learning was put online and was really disastrous in many ways for student outcomes in terms of disengaging students from their education, that we would have learned that this doesn't work and that would sort of stop that trend. But unfortunately, there's so much money and political power behind it that, and now with AI, that it's just accelerating even more.
Yes. So many things that you brought up that I can't wait to dig into. I want to thank you so much, Leonie, for joining us on KBOO. Thank you, Jamie Partridge, for helping us convert this to a radio-ready file. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. to catch another Labor.
What do we mean when we talk about personality? What is your personality? It is the way you get along with other people around you and with your changing environment. You want certain things from other people. The way to go about getting those things reveals your personality. Your personality is the way you affect other people. Think about that. The way you affect other people.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now.